This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, and that means time for the Week in Review. Today, we're joined by panelist Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Hi there, Jim.
Good to be with you.
Also, John Carroll, Professor of Communications at Boston University and WBUR Senior Analyst. Hi there, John.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so let's jump right in with the big news of the week, which actually came out today. Another big housing report. I mean, we already know that the rent is too damn high. Today's report says so are building costs. Here's Northeastern's Barry Bluestone.
Unless we can find ways of bringing down land costs, zoning costs, construction costs, it will be almost impossible for any developer to put up housing in Greater Boston that working families can afford.
So one of the suggested solutions in the report, the Boston Foundation says universities and hospitals could build more housing for their young professional workers. But Steve Meacham from City Life Vita Urbana says that is not enough.
I don't think it's going to remove the pressure. I think there's no way to remove the pressure other than getting some kind of control on the market forces. You have to have an anti-displacement plan along with your housing instruction plan.
Okay, so Jim and John, let's first start off with the one of the big takeaways is that not only is it costly to buy or rent, it's costly to build. What's your reaction to that, Jim?
Well, you know, this is one of those, we already know this story. We've known this for quite some time. There have been lots of studies around this, and they focused really on rental housing. So it's a piece of the market, but it represents, I think, what's happening in the region. And I would agree with the commenter at the end, the suggestions are useful, but they don't break new ground. If you think about Tom Menino, pushed a lot of universities to create dorms, free
right.
up housing for folks who are, you know, living in the city who are not students. As far as public funding for housing, it doesn't address the cost issue. So it's dealing with the symptoms. So, you know, I think there's a lot we can do, but we would actually have to take a look at the regulations, how we're actually zoning for development. And frankly, we're going to have to do some things that are pretty uncomfortable for folks. I mean, little things we stop towns and cities from doing, because it's not just a Boston thing. It's a town thing and a city thing as well. Just to give you one example, if you have a large house in Newton and you want to create an accessory apartment within your house, not changing the footprint, not changing traffic patterns, anything like that, it is extremely hard. And you could... That's the sort of thing that we have that blocks the system from actually responding to demand in some way.
Right. John, what are your thoughts?
Well, not only is the rent too damn high, the economy is too damn good. And so what's happening is
we're having this
influx of population. And that's true for some people. And it's interesting that back in 2013, when there was the mayoral race, one of Marty Walsh's major points was, we don't want to become New York. You know, it was the tale of two Bostons, the very rich and the very poor. We don't want to become New York. This study seems to indicate that that's the direction we're going in. And one of the issues that it raises is a lot of the housing we have is the wrong kind of housing.
Right, right.
We have a lot of family size housing without enough families to fill them up. So what you have is a shift in the living arrangements for a lot of young people, not the most desirable setup to have for young people coming looking at Boston. So I think that there's a whole number of dynamics at work here that are pushing the market toward more and more exclusivity, more and more difficulty in building, and more and more squeezing of the middle class out of Boston
right.
and into other areas.
You know, just for some context here, the report says that a 1,600 square foot apartment costs more than $430,000 just to build. So, I mean, that's kind of a stunning number when you think about it. There's so much to dig in here, though. And let me ask you, I'm wondering about, for example, the unintended consequences of efforts to actually get more affordable housing on the market. I'm thinking of, the city's policy of inclusionary development, right, that requires developers to discount somewhat 13% of units in new projects for low-income families. But, of course, developers are saying, well, having to do that just raises our prices even further. I mean, does that hold water, Jim?
You know, that's stuff at the edges. And I think that to support what John was just saying, we are becoming a city that is a tale of two cities. And I think the larger issues that the study is getting at, which, again, we've known about for a long time, it's the cost of development because of the environmental regulations. I'm not saying we should gut them. The zoning regulations, which are frankly much more intrusive than the environmental regulations. And some of the costs in Boston, for example, are related to having to have, in most cases, unionized labor providing the construction. Now, you know, just to give you one example of a proposal you could make that would help to address some of this stuff, the MBTA is one of the largest landowners in the eastern part of the state. Most of the land that they own is right around transit nodes or would-be transit nodes. So a plan that builds on what the mayor is doing to build thousands of new units, but actually focusing on the MBTA-owned land and providing some sort of pathway for developers to do more intensive development around those transit nodes might be a kind of smart thing to think about.
So, Jim, I imagine there's some people listening who say, oh, there goes Jim and the Pioneer Institute on unions and the T and permitting. But I mean, I take your point that there are creative solutions here that maybe we aren't giving enough credence to. But John, before we move on, I do want to ask you about this, one of the solutions that the Boston Foundation report mentioned, which was universities and hospitals, say, building more houses for their students and employees. While on paper that might seem like a good idea, but I could immediately think of several problems. Like, one, what if you wanted to switch jobs? Would you lose your housing? Two, at what point in time does it look like a factory city?
Right.
You know, I mean, it didn't seem like a solution that really gets us significantly down the road to fixing the problem.
And three, I don't have tenure, so I'm going to be really careful about how I answer this one. No, I think that could provide a small part of the solution. But one of the biggest parts of this is land itself. The cost of land has gone up dramatically, 40% over the last, I think, 10 or 15 years. They asked George Burns, the comedian, why did he invest so much in real estate? And he said, God made the world, but he's not making any more of it. And, you know, I think that's one of the issues. And the city of Boston is selling off parcels. Charlie Baker says the state's going to sell off parcels. That might help, too, because I think land is at such a premium at this point that drives the cost up dramatically.
Right. But one thing which we all agree on that we can't escape is that I don't think anybody wants Boston to turn into a place where only the exclusive or the very, very poor.
That would be sad.
That would be a tragedy, and that's not the future that any of us want. Okay. Well, let's move on now to DraftKings, and let's talk about gambling, or maybe it's not gambling. The one thing we know is it is fantasy sports.
I don't think it's gambling. It's a game of skill.
Well, that's Governor Baker's take. That was him yesterday. He also says he wants greater consumer protection for those who do play fantasy sports.
It's a new enterprise. It's a new business. It's a new way of engaging people in these games of skill. And I think it's important when you have one of those to make sure you have the right kinds of consumer protections in place to be sure people are playing on a level playing field. That, to me, is kind of the biggest and most important part. And that is something I really do want guidance from the AG about.
Okay, notice that Governor Baker went to great pains to make sure he called it a game of skill. But earlier this week, the New York AG ordered DraftKings and FanDuel, by the way, to stop collecting bets there, basically saying it's gambling. This morning, DraftKings, Boston-based, of course, filed suit against the New York Attorney General. So, John, let's start with you. How does this all shake out?
Well, first of all, level the playing field. I mean, 90% of the winnings go to 1% of the players. So, number one, that's not gambling. You know, I mean, that is basically they're taking the vast majority of the winnings. And that's because they have complicated algorithm systems. I mean, these guys are pros who are winning. So leveling the playing field, I think, is not a realistic objective. I think regulation is. I think taxation is. And I think, you know, the state's going to find its way to there. The Massachusetts Gaming Commission supposedly is looking into it in a couple of ways. They're looking into it thinking maybe we should start some fantasy sports contests, and maybe we should be looking to regulate it as well. That's what happened in Nevada. Nevada said it's gambling. Go get a gambling license. Otherwise, you can't operate here. So that may be one of the solutions as well.
Right. So if the capital of gambling in the United States says it's gambling, maybe that might be how it works out here. But Attorney General Maura Healey said this week that her office is still reviewing the industry. I mean, Jim, I'm wondering, do we have sort of a false dichotomy here? I mean, the conversation, not specifically this one, but writ large in Massachusetts is like, is it gambling or is it a game of skill? I mean, it's kind of both, isn't it? I mean,
well, I'd say first and foremost, I thank you for going to John first, because I have absolutely no interest in sports, and my interest in fake sports is probably even lower than that. So
this is a policy question.
I understand.
Billions of dollars are at stake.
Can't you do a white paper on this, Jeff?
I am not interested. To be serious for a second, on the substance, I think there is there is a good reason to go slow, but to keep our eyes and our minds open to regulating it or treating it as gambling. And the reason I say to go slow is I think, you know, one of the beauties of the American system is we're not France, where you have to make a disposition immediately. This is the pathway we have to take. We can watch what Eric Schneiderman's doing there. We can watch what some other states are doing, monitor it. And frankly, the Attorney General should be trying to collect specific data around some of the outcomes, some of the things that John was talking about before. And we should be ready to regulate it if we think that it is something that's actually impacting people negatively, or if it looks and quacks like a duck and is gambling.
So, Jim, I'm now going to set ourselves a challenge to find a topic that you care so little about that you're not thoughtful about it, because we haven't found that topic yet. Saying you're not interested in fantasy sports, but still giving us thoughtful analysis. Okay.
Oh, thank you.
That is why we keep inviting you back. All right. So let's move on to something else of greater substance, even though it has to do with wind, because stop me if you've heard this one before. There is someone who wants to build an offshore wind farm off the coast of Massachusetts. But this one is not Cape Wind. It's a project called Bay State Wind, and it's being proposed by Denmark-based Dong Energy. And if constructed, it's going to be America's largest offshore wind farm. So Matt Morrissey is executive director of Offshore Wind Massachusetts. They're the trade group representing Dong Energy. He spoke with us about why meeting the state's energy needs, he says, is more urgent now than ever.
The reality is Massachusetts has a tremendous challenge ahead of us in that we really have substantial capacity problems. We have major older plants that are shutting down, and we really need to make up energy. And the question before Massachusetts policymakers right now is, what kind of energy mix will there be to make up the shortfall that we will have to deal with in, you know, the next 2 or 3 years.
So a policy take there, but it occurs to me, I didn't say perhaps the most important thing about Bay State Wind, the proposed project, is that it would be 15 miles off the coast of Martha's Vineyard and not off the offshore of the Kennedy compound instead. So, John, let me first get your first take on the likelihood or positives or negatives of Bay State Wind.
Well, I don't want to be the skunk at the garden party here, but
this, you will,
this
anyway.
this is Don Quixote written all over it.
Oh, come on.
Seriously. This is
a company that's done wind farms all over Europe very successfully.
They've done wind farms all over Europe. They haven't encountered the Massachusetts resistance to getting anything like this done. I think, is it possible it could get done? Yes, I think it is. I think there are obstacles in the way, major obstacles. One of them being they're so far offshore that they need a particular kind of shipping capability to get the turbines out there, which are much bigger than the ones that that Cape Wind was proposing. There's one question, do we have the maritime infrastructure to do that? Another is, there's a whole bunch of whales out there.
Right.
And is this going to affect the whaling habitat? And if so, I mean, this can drag out for years and years and years. I mean, how long has Cape Wind been tilting at turbines? It's been 15 years now. So again, I don't want to be pessimistic about this, but I would be cautiously pessimistic about the overall chances of this.
Okay, so you mentioned Cape Wind. That is a much-needed reality check. I'll grant you that. But Matt Morrissey, who we talked to earlier, again, from Offshore Wind Massachusetts, I asked him about this, and he claimed, and we're going to hear him in this piece of tape now, he claimed that the energy climate is just basically different now than when Cape Wind was trying to get off the ground 15 years ago.
The opportunity today is actually quite different than the pioneering project Cape Wind first was proposed. I mean, the whole industry really has matured since then. And today, offshore wind is incredibly competitive.
I want to get one more voice in here, and that's Audra Parker, who is, of course, one of the most ardent opponents of Cape Wind. She actually likes the idea of Bay State Wind right now. She likes the site, and here's what she told WBUR.
It's a much better site with fewer conflicts. The site selection was based on including public input. It didn't ignore the fishermen. It didn't ignore the tribes.
Now, Jim, John brought up some really important issues. The whales, the maritime infrastructure, the site does have certain challenges. But what's your take on what we just heard, that there, at least from the people who were the most ardent opponents of Cape Wind, they don't seem so opposed to the idea of Bay State Wind?
Yeah, I completely agree with what John said before, and I would add to what Matt Morrissey said, that when he says it's competitively priced, I just don't believe that. That all said, You're talking about 100 very large turbines that can produce double the energy that Cape Wind could. You're talking about a company that can probably self-finance. This doesn't have to go to the markets to finance. That's extremely important. They want a foothold here in the United States. It's next to what is a site under construction already by Deepwater Wind.
Right, Rhode
Island,
right.
It's in an area that doesn't get that kind of opposition. I think it really depends on two things. Can they truly self-finance? And the second one is, can they actually beat the 21 cents per kilowatt hour price that Cape Wind was going after? And if they can do that, and they don't have to go after mandating long-term contracts, then maybe. And I think one thing that has changed, I disagree with Matt on the maturity of the industry for Massachusetts and for the country, because this country doesn't like these sorts of projects very much. But the big asterisk on this and the big opportunity is Pilgrim Nuclear is being decommissioned. And you don't – a lot of the advocates will not want to see that energy replaced with fossil fuels.
Right.
So, you know, to be seen.
For as much as people didn't like nuclear, it was a major part of our clean energy or non-fossil fuel-based targets that we wanted to make for 2020. John, let me ask you about something that Jim said, because, you know, Cape Wind aside, one thing that Dong Energy is pushing for, at least we know right now they're pushing for, is a law change on Beacon Hill to allow them to have long-term contracts with the utilities, which Cape Wind never got. And they're saying, at least from what I'm seeing so far, is that going forward with Bay State Wind requires those long-term contracts so they can get over the price differential that they're almost certainly going to have at the start. That's a sticky piece of politics on Beacon Hill.
It certainly is. And the long-term contract, losing a long-term contract, was the Waterloo for Cape Wind. They had had a contract with Eversource and National Grid that went away. And so Cape Wind has sort of gone away. Charlie Baker, initially anyway, has not indicated that he's all that enthusiastic about mandated long-term contracts. So I think that's going to be an uphill battle for anybody who wants to build here. On the other hand, there is, as Jim says, you know, there's this problem with energy, clean energy, the desire for clean energy. I think there's a meeting of hydroelectric people this weekend, and I think that that's a place where Charlie Baker has seemed to indicate he's much more enthusiastic about looking at hydroelectric as an alternative to carbon-based energy. So we may see that. There's a long way to go. They're talking
right.
about this maybe being built by the beginning of the next decade. Mm. So it's a long haul, and a lot of things can change.
Well, and yeah, it is a big difference between Cape Wind and Dong Energy. Dong Energy has brought in $11 billion of revenue.
Right.
So they're the biggest player in the world on this. Maybe they can make it happen. We will see. Let's turn quickly to another significant piece of news this week, and that is the future of testing in Massachusetts schools. Yesterday, Commissioner of Elementary and Secondary Education Mitchell Chester released his recommendation for what schools should do. Is it MCAS or is it PARC? Well, it turns out it's kind of something in between. MCAS 2.0, which is a mix of MCAS and PARC, and Governor Charlie Baker praised Mitchell Chester's recommendation.
I'm glad to see that the commissioner basically recommended that Massachusetts should develop what I would call sort of an MCAS 2.0, which means we set our own terms, we build our own test, and we do what we think makes sense for the kids here in the Commonwealth.
All right, Jim, are you a happy man?
Am I happy, man? Look, I think it's the right choice in the sense that Massachusetts should control its own destiny. The MCAS has deteriorated in terms of its rigor in the 10th grade, not the 4th and 8th grade, but the 10th grade. And frankly, that's a lot of the department's doing. What I'd say is I really don't know where the commissioner's consistency has been on this, though. And that is to say, PARC is great, PARC is great. If you really thought that, you would think the recommendation would have come out that way. He's talked about we were ready to implement it. Technology was in place to do it. Now technology's not going to be ready until 2019. We've heard a lot of talk about there's a little too much testing, but PARC requires much more testing than MCAS, has no more predictive value. So, you know, I think it's the right choice because I think having control over the test is the right thing for Massachusetts. But I also recognize that MCAS needs to be improved in terms of its rigor because it has deteriorated over the past 7 years.
Okay.
So let's see what they do with it. One thing I would note is PARC has just come out and said the same day that people can pick and choose elements, test items, and all that sort of thing.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Can I just jump in here?
Yeah,
because,
please.
Because that's a major change, right? And to me, that my first question was, Well, then what's the point of PARC, right? Because it's supposed to be linked to the Common Core, which are supposed to be nationwide standards. And if you don't have a so if states can pick and choose how they want to shape their own PARC test now, we're not testing anything standard then across the country. So what's the point?
That, I think, is absolutely correct. I would say this. Look, what worries me is this. If Massachusetts wants to use PARC elements in the MCAS test, and I'm sure there are good ones they can actually put in, but I worry about the coherence and reliability of the test. And it takes a long time to do that. So I hope they don't try to do that for this spring. And frankly, I hope they try to do it for the spring after, taking a year in their time and being deliberate about how they put together a test to make sure it's actually coherently representing what they want the kids to learn. We don't want to waste their time.
Yeah. John?
Yeah, I have one suggestion that they're picking and choosing, because there were lower proficiency scores on PARC than on MCAS for Massachusetts students. So I say take the parts of PARC that the Massachusetts students did really well on and incorporate those into MCAS. And that way you'll have a more representative test.
Hmm, interesting. You like that idea? Maybe?
I'd have to take a look at it.
I was actually only kidding, but okay.
See, you delivered that with such sincerity, though, Joe. Well,
I'm trying to come up to Jim's level at this point.
Well, so you see, you're doing well with the testing. Jim did well with fantasy sports. So we're all happy in the end.
We'll try it later on today.
We've got just enough time for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that weren't the top of the fold, as we say, I guess, in the news business. Jim, let's start with you. What's your hubbub?
Well, I don't think people are really scared of Friday the 13th today, or even the number 13 anymore, but for a long time they were, to the point where there is a name for fear of 13, triskaidekaphobia. And that phobia is even stronger if it's Friday the 13th. The problem this year is it's happened a lot. This is the third time this year we've had Friday the 13th, which reminds me there's people who are fearful of the number 3. I don't know them, but they're there. They suffer from triskaphobia. So 2015 has shaped up as a terrible year if you suffer from both triskaphobia and triskaidekaphobia. I was just thinking about that as the clock passed 3:13.
Oh, God, yeah. And John, your hubbub?
My hubbub is Elizabeth Warren's cameo appearance at the GOP debate on Tuesday night. There was an ad run by a group called the American Action Network that was attacking the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the so-called brainchild of Elizabeth Warren. And they showed this room filled with faceless bureaucrats, and hanging above it was a Soviet-style Red Party banner with Elizabeth Warren's face on it. This was sort of to show kind of the nature of the bureau, making decisions about your personal financial decisions. Elizabeth Warren came out with a tweet and said, you know, can I object to this depiction of me as a commie dictator? So she's somewhere right now, a cross between a commie dictator and sort of the daughter that Vladimir Lenin never had. And I think it put her in a great position to go out and fundraise and do that kind of thing, because she doesn't want to be depicted that way in any commercial.
It's true. But, I mean, virtually anything the GOP does to caricature Senator Warren is only going to help her fundraise.
Money in the bank. Right. Money in the bank.
So she ought to say thank you, I guess. So my hubbub has to do with the MBTA. I feel like my hubbubs are either animal hubbubs or tea hubbubs. So this week it's a tea hubbub. Because everyone must have heard of the fact that the tea, you know, put out a survey about wanting to reach out to riders and users to pick the new paint schemes for the green, red, and orange lines. But they used SurveyMonkey, which I can't even get this out without laughing, because one of my producers said this morning, like, isn't that the tool that college students use to write their really crappy papers when they need data?
Yes.
So they just put out SurveyMonkey tool. And of course, the T's survey on SurveyMonkey got hacked, and they put out the results of what paint schemes won. They realized, oh my God, they got hacked, so they had to redo the results, and they found out that, yes, okay, well, the unhacked version of the results came out, and, you know, kind of the boring-ish paint schemes won, but then I checked what the results were with the SurveyMonkey hack, and it was the second boringest paint schemes, in my opinion. So it just what killed me was that I figured that this would be a chance for tea writers to choose something exciting. But we didn't. Like, we still chose the boring paint jobs. So I was hoping that the hack might have let us have like the splashy paint job. That
I would think they would just choose some service. That would be the ideal thing to choose.
That was option E that you couldn't actually click on,
right,
I guess. All right. Well, Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Always great to have you. Thanks
Truly
so much.
Truly good to be with you.
And John Carroll, Professor of Communications at Boston University and WBUR Senior Analyst. Always great to have you as well.
Likewise. Thank you.
And we thought that the team maybe next time ought to have like a text-based survey. You know, that's maybe less hackable. All right. There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.